post-war period, America has kind of adopted the European or the English country manor type of lawn. And that has been the dominant type of landscape. But over the last several years, business and homeowners and landowners and property owners have recognized that there is an opportunity for diversity and an opportunity not only to have a change from that traditional country manor lawn, but to have something that is resilient for the environment and enjoyable to the public. So the purpose of Bill 2618, my intent here, is actually to allow property owners to have pollinator habitat, because the dominant condition out there is that they may not be allowed to have that in a city. And so we have quite a precedent throughout state government of the state preempting certain activity. What we're dealing with here is allowing folks in cities to have a pollinator lawn or a pollinator property. Now, it needs to be managed and it needs to be recognized. You can't just let your lawn go, and that's very clear in the statute. So I know there will be some concerns about local control, but I have some testifiers here that are going to talk about the science and the opportunity and the freedom to be having a pollinator lawn. So, Madam Chair, back to you.
Thank you very much. We do have a number of testifiers. And the first one I have is Elaine Evans from the Department of Entomology at the University of Minnesota. If you would state your name for the record and proceed, please.
My name is Elaine Evans from the University of Minnesota Bee Lab. And I have a couple images to share, if I can do that. Let's see. Of course, I'm on a different computer than usual. Thank you for having me here, Madam Chair, Committee. And what Representative Hansen was saying was right in line with the science, where we know that having habitat, that pollinators respond really quickly to that. And native plants in particular are really crucial habitat. So we've got a few different pieces that I want to point out that are particularly important. So for the rusty patch bumblebee, this is an federally protected endangered species. And Minnesota is one of the only places where this pollinator is still found. A lot of the recent sightings for this endangered species are actually on private property, and most of them are in urban areas. We know that they do really well with having more flowers, having more habitat, particularly native plants. And just to mention, with the rusty patch bumblebee, the goal of any endangered species is to have them delisted, have them not be endangered. So having it be easier for people on private property, especially in cities, to be able to provide habitat for them is really crucial for them. I see that there's a hand raised. I'm not sure if I should pause here.
Okay. Representative Quam, do you have a question for the speaker?
At the end of this presentation. Thank you,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Because I thought I was going to try to take all the testifiers first, but thank you for noticing that.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't sure what the procedure was here. Another particular group of bees that I want to mention are specialist bees. So these are native bees that are completely dependent on particular native plants. So having a diversity of native plants is really crucial. These bees actually cannot survive on just any flowers that are out there. They need the flowers that they are dependent on. And just to mention that there's all of this, all of these other animals that can benefit from having this kind of habitat. Birds is one group that we know a lot about and that a lot of people are interested in. And something that, that homeowners can see really quickly, you can start to see things like goldfinches showing up and you know, eating the seeds that are being produced there. Another thing to think about is what's happening below the ground. So we see all these things happening above ground with native plants, but another kind of tiered benefit is that they have these deep roots, and so they can do a lot more than turf can in terms of things like stormwater filtration and carbon storage. So there's these tiered benefits beyond just pollinators. So I wanted to keep keep brief here, just say that that the University of Minnesota Bee Lab, I also consulted with other people at the Bee Lab, that we're really excited about the opportunities that this bill provides to really encourage this very practical, easy, and quick solution to help mobilize everybody in Minnesota to be able to provide more habitat for pollinators.
Thank you so much. Next, we have Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. I would like to start just with a brief background for those of you who haven't regularly heard from our organization. The League of Minnesota Cities is the statewide association that represents city governments in the state. There are 854 cities in the state of Minnesota. 837 of them are active members of the league, and the dozen or so that aren't are all under 200 in population, and we would certainly answer their phone calls and help them if they called. They just don't have a regular need for our work. We very much appreciate the efforts that the bill author has put into all of the issues around urban vegetation for pollinators, for emerald ash borer, for a wide range of other issues. And we will definitely be working with Representative Hansen on this concept as things move forward. And we appreciate the committee taking the time to hear local government concerns. But we do regrettably have to list a few of those with the way that this piece of legislation is drafted right now. The League of Minnesota Cities has been very supportive of a wide range of vegetative solutions, and in particular for pollinator purposes. We have actively encouraged and provide educational materials and have for almost 20 years now for cities related to rain gardens, to other benefits of urban forestry and urban plantings. And we supported the Lawns to Legume program that the bill author created a few years ago and has supported since then with additional funding. In fact, the League helped with the Board of Water and Soil Resources drafting the model ordinances used in that program. And we continue to advertise it and make sure cities are making their citizens aware of it, and helping cities work who need to adapt their ordinances to be to work within that program. The concerns I have are, I'm just going to go through very quickly, Madam Chair, to keep you on time, and people are welcome to ask questions as they feel they need to. I would first of all point out that cities have a statutory mandate, unfunded, under agricultural law in section 18.80. And your bit of trivia for the day is that the mayor of every city in the state of Minnesota is designated by statute as the local weed inspector. And it is their statutory obligation to examine and enforce any noxious weed laws that the state adopts within the boundaries of that city, or they have to designate an assistant local weed inspector to do that for them, which works better in a big city with public works staff than it does in a small city that doesn't have much of those. So our mayor weed inspectors are the ones that would have to do a lot of the work related to this bill. And with that in mind, we really do want to raise the issue of local control here, that the decision on how best to balance the property interests and the needs of various development and properties within a neighborhood and within a community really are meant to be made by the local decision makers who are elected for that purpose. And we have cities throughout the state that are very actively supporting and working on natural lawn ordinances, have been very active with lawns to legumes and other programs, and have just passed the ordinances without those programs to allow people to put in the types of vegetation they would like to have in their lawns. But we do still have to balance that with our statutory obligation to enforce state weed laws. In particular, this sets a one-size-fits-all sort of ordinance that says all cities will have the following allowances. One, that is something that may be very challenging for a city with fewer or no staff to deal with the program. And two, it could be contrary to or require significant reworking of cities that have had successful natural lawn programs and ordinances in place already, and force them to have to redo a lot of that work. And the reason this all gets complicated, Madam Chair and members, is because the enforcement of these laws comes down to nuisance ordinances. And that is a very difficult bar for our communities to have to meet, to demonstrate nuisance to a degree worthy of someone being required to do something on their property. And so we feel very strongly that we need to be careful when making major changes to how a city would do that or what would constitute that. In particular with this, as our staff and our mayors are trying to do their responsibilities for weed ordinances, we cannot go on private property. So it needs to be done as a drive-by or on a complaint basis. And it could be difficult for less highly trained staff in a natural lawn setting to identify and pick out noxious weeds that are growing within that surface area. And so it's going to take some work to figure out how that would work and how we prevent the actual weeds that we're supposed to be stopping from popping up in a natural lawn in a place where we really don't have highly trained gardeners as our local weed inspectors. Happy to continue to work with the author and committees as we discuss this moving forward, but we would suggest that rather than putting mandates in place that affect every city in the state, that we look at continuing to provide resources for property owners who want to do these kinds of surfaces changes to their landscaping, and that we consider putting some resources in place for cities to have these kinds of programs and to develop them. Right now, that is completely unfunded, and it's something cities have to do in response to a request from local residents, typically. And so having good resources available, like we have started to have through the Lawns to Legumes program with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, I think is a direction that is working well for our cities, and we would like to continue moving in that direction to see us improve the flexibility of property owners to have different types of lawns. And with that, Madam Chair, I am happy to wait for questions later. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. And if speakers would keep their presentations 1 to 2 minutes, it would be appreciated. Next, we have Heidi Highland from Heidi's Grow House and Lifestyle Gardens.
Good morning. My name is Heidi Highland. 43 years ago, I planted the seeds of my landscape gardening company. 6 years ago, I bought a nursery and garden center in Corcoran, and I'm also past president of the MNLA. I've informed many diverse customers over the years, and these are my school beliefs of why it's important to support House File 2618 for our industry and for the health of our planet. Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee, and Representative Hansen for hearing my testimony. Nature heals, period. This has been proven by many, from scientists to NASA, and by peer-reviewed papers written by horticultural therapists. Not surprisingly, during COVID, more of the world has come to know what many of us have been practicing for years. Being in nature, or even viewing scenes of nature, reduces stress, lowers heart rate, relieves pain, and increases happiness. Not only does nature improve our personal well-being, but diverse plantings, and even more specifically, native plantings, provide a myriad of necessary benefits to our world. Supporting this request for private property rights increases our potential to heal the planet, one garden at a time. The next generation understands the importance of a managed natural landscape. The expected Kentucky bluegrass lawn is not native, nor is it natural. A typical urban lawn requires copious amounts of water and mowing, and mowing it weekly creates unnecessary noise and air pollution. Water is a limited resource that we do need to protect. Native plants are adapted to their environments and are therefore more drought tolerant. Proper landscaping reduces nitrate leaching from the soil into our water supply and also reduces surface water runoff, keeping phosphorus and other pollutants out of our waterways, thus preventing septic system overload. Lastly, by now, we should all be familiar with the reality that native habitats are essential for our birds, bees, and butterflies to thrive. The flora and fauna of every region plays a key role in a healthy ecosystem. Reversing the negative effects of climate change, honoring water, food, and healing will only be achieved by encouraging all homeowners to grow more plants. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I have Jason Rath, Field Outdoor Spaces.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
State your name and proceed, please.
Yeah, I'm Jason Rathy, owner of Field Outdoor Spaces. Thank you for having me here to talk about this important issue. So I own Field Outdoor Spaces Landscape Company. It's a residential landscape company based in Northeast Minneapolis. We started in 2005, and our main service area is Minneapolis, St. Paul, and small yard inner ring suburbs. I'm here to talk about the importance of allowing natural landscapes in our residential communities. While traditional cool season grass lawns are a fine option for covering ground, there are other options that can be a better option for supporting our pollinators, decreasing water use, and decreasing the energy consumption of mowers and other equipment. These options include alternative lawns like no-mow fescue grass, dynamic flower and grass lawn mixes like the B-Lawn, advocated by the state of Minnesota's Lawn to Legumes program, and many types of planted shortgrass meadows. Some of these include native plants, and others are primarily adapted plant species appropriate for climate and residential landscapes. These landscape options not only offer ecological advantages, but when well designed, can be tidy, visually appealing, straightforward to manage, and an asset to the community streetscape. At my company, Field Outdoor Spaces, we are able to help our clients achieve their goals because of ordinances that allow natural landscapes. And I think it's important that everyone in Minnesota have that option. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I have Scott Frampton, Landscape Innovations. If you'll state your name and proceed. You're muted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and community members. It is landscape renovations. We can use it landscape renovations. And we all have landscape renovations.
Scott, you're not coming through clear. Is there something you can do with your sound system?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Is this better? Is this better? No? All right, bear with me.
I don't know.
Is this better, Madam Chair?
Okay, that's better.
This is better? Okay, I apologize for that. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. It's the company name is Landscape Renovations, and we're based in the South Washington County area of the Twin Cities. And I would like to echo what Jason and Heidi presented and offer respect to Craig Johnson's concerns as well. I would simply like to add that in South Washington County, the South Washington County School District and the South Washington County Parks have been converting some of their turf areas to natural landscapes, I would say successfully as a resident. I have noticed that they have done a fantastic job of maintaining and caring for these naturalized areas, and they've had added significant beauty to the parkland and to the South Washington County School District properties. I do believe that all of the benefits that Heidi and Jason suggested are very beneficial to the residents of Minnesota, to the children, to the adults that are attracted to these spaces for the natural beauty, the flowers, the bees. Also, I'd like to add that creating these spaces, converting the turf to a natural landscape, is a benefit to the state of Minnesota by creating tax revenue, creating job opportunities for people to improve these properties for the natural landscape as well. I really don't have anything else to add. I think everyone so far has really done a great job of giving input on this topic, on this bill. I would support HF 2618.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Paulita LaPlante, a prescription landscape. If you'll state your name and proceed, please.
Good morning, I'm Paulita LaPlante, and I'm a co-owner of Prescription Landscape headquartered in St. Paul with branches in Crystal, Shakopee, and St. Paul. We serve commercial clients. Over the past 5 years, we've installed numerous urban pollinator gardens, small native prairies for banks, hospitals, and retail clients. One of our divisions actually installed the Bee Lab, Elaine. The rooftop and amenity decks that feature pollinator-friendly plants are increasingly popular, as are green roofs. In 2019, we were awarded the landscape contract for the new Minnehaha Academy Upper School on West River Parkway and 32nd. One element of the landscape included planting the boulevards with native grasses and forbs, or wildflowers. The school management said that their pollinator boulevards were necessary to being good neighbors and environmental stewards because the surrounding community in a 2 to 3 block radius puts a high value on environmental justice. And you see many of those are non-traditional front yards and boulevards. Recognizing the importance the Academy placed on community acceptance and participation, once we had the boulevard plantings completed, we provided their environmental club students in the biology department an educational module that contained their pollinator boulevard design, the images of each grass and flower, as well as the backstory of the pollinators each supported. Importantly, to Craig's point earlier, we also included images of weeds, look-alike weeds and look-alike flowers especially, and we emphasize the importance of maintenance. My points, I support the Bill 2618. Pollinator-friendly commercial installs are increasingly seen as important assets. Leadership by schools, hospitals, banks, and retail can be important to encouraging community acceptance of pollinator-friendly residential yards and can also serve as sources of inspiration and education, as can companies like Jason's and Scott's and Heidi's. Close-knit large neighborhoods that are united in their acceptance of non-traditional yards, like those around Minnehaha Academy, are unique. So education and communication can be very important to community acceptance and the success of non-traditional yards. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Tim Maluli, Irrigation by Design. State your name and proceed, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Maluli, and I am a member of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. My focus is on water. Briefly, the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, I serve as a committee chair in the Government Affairs Program. And like Heidi and Scott, I'm a past president of the association. The organization has got about 1,200 member companies, 30 to 45,000 employees annually. It's located throughout the state of Minnesota, or has members located throughout the state of Minnesota, and accounts for billions of dollars of revenue. Related to the economy of the landscape and the outdoor living environment. We're the designers, the planters, and the maintainers of the outdoor living environment. And as I mentioned, my specialty is water resources, but my focus today is to offer some information that might help create a clearing for greater Minnesota communities, as well as larger cities, to workably adopt modernized local ordinances related to the managed natural landscape. Briefly, older nuisance laws were founded with good intentions to protect the public health, welfare, and safety. However, weed ordinances that restrict natural landscaping have become increasingly outdated as a result of growing evidence that native landscapes do not contribute to fire, risk, vermin, mosquitoes, or pollen proliferation. In addition, nuisance ordinances that fail to define a particular vegetation to be controlled have been ruled in some areas unconstitutionally vague by some courts. This is cited by EPA, and I can furnish some citations later if you wish. That being said, the new generation of plant ordinances helps local governing bodies address potential constitutional and common law violations that result from restrictions over individual landscape choices that don't serve a public benefit. Most weed laws currently regulate landscaping based on broad physical plant characteristics. For instance, brush or seed-bearing plants and plants capable of large growth may make natural landscaping unlawful. Another obstacle is an ordinance provision that restricts plant growth beyond a specific height. In the 1990s, municipalities began adopting a new generation of ordinances or code amendments to protect native plants. Some revisions include the addition of a section in the nuisance ordinance that is entitled Managed Natural Landscapes or Planned Natural Landscapes. These ordinance revisions exempt areas designated by the landowner from the weed ordinance. In Minneapolis in 2011, it altered its noxious plant ordinance to make a simple three-category distinction between noxious weeds, defined by existing state statutes, unmaintained growth, and intentional growth called managed natural landscapes. These landscapes are defined as planned, intentional, and maintained plantings of native and non-native plants. Plants that fall in this category are allowed to exceed the 8-inch height limit for grasses as long as they are absent of noxious weeds and the plants do not constitute a health or safety or fire risk. This ordinance does not include setback requirements and no government or neighborhood review process is necessary. So this is offered by me today for your consideration, and I can furnish this in writing if you'd like it to refer to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is the last testifier that I have. Am I missing anyone? Okay, we can proceed to questions then. Representative Quam and then Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this could be improved by having a, if you're going for the native and you want to promote specific plants because endangered pollinators need this. We already have an approach for milkweed and the monarch, and we designate. So I think if this bill included a list of promoted or suggested natural plants, you make it easier for people to go ahead and plant them, include them, etc. But you also make it easier for the towns, cities, and any enforcing people to understand, because you can have a reference page with pictures, which I think some of the groups have talked about having. And that way you don't have the confusion, you avoid the conflict of, well, this is natural. Well, we think this is, you know. But if you have in your bill included a reference to a table of plants, that would take care, I think, of a lot of the issues. Next would be allowing for a, a 3-foot or whatever offset from a sidewalk. Because if you've got an elementary school and kids are walking by, there may be a student that's allergic to bee stings or et cetera. And that way, you wouldn't have the opportunity of brushing. In other words, allowing with the League of Minnesota Cities and others, little things like, a set aside for a sidewalk, providing the information so they can better understand what's happening. Little things like that would take care of the argument and make it much more structured. So that's my suggestion to make this a more of a peace in the valley type bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Do you have a response?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. It sounds like what you're asking is kind of a paragraph of the University of Minnesota shall work with the state agencies and League of Cities to provide materials on native vegetation and pollinators. And I think we have some language like that when we did some of the pollinator work in 13 and 14, where the Board of Water and Soil Resources developed kind of planting guides for farmers and others. So I think the material is there. Representative Quam, is that what you're talking about, kind of a guidance or make sure that there's availability to the local governments so that they have the proper information when they are doing code enforcement?
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that is along the lines, but I mean, we specifically, I believe it's specifically listed in statute, the milkweed, and I think a few other instances. So if there was a list that was, in there for reference, and, frankly, I think there would be, it'd behoove to have in here, cities may require up to a 3 foot, 4 foot space, set aside from, access, so that you see where I'm headed on this, because there are logical reasons, and it's reasonable to have some constraints for sidewalks, maybe visibility on street corners if you're corner lot, things like that are fairly common, and that way we at least allow the cities some local control in special situations. And then I'm not specifically trying an oral amendment. I'm just saying that the best route probably would be including a couple of those items. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hansen and then Ms. Evans after.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Quam, it sounds like you're talking about having some clarification on safety rather than nuisance, that the city authority may be on safety. I believe the bill is leaving this committee today and going to state government. I'd be happy to work with you on its path as it goes to the next committee.
Thank you. Ms. Evans?
I just wanted to mention for the endangered species, supporting the endangered species, we do have some lists of plants. They tend to be very long, as it's very different than the monarch, which is very specific to milkweed, whereas the rusty patch bumblebee uses a really wide variety of plants. But it certainly is possible to make recommendations, for plants that would be most suitable for people to plant.
Thank you. I didn't see which one came first, but I'll go with Representative Elkins and then Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So question for Mr. Johnson. Typically when topics like this up, the League of Minnesota Cities acts as an information clearinghouse and assembles resources, including, usually sets of model ordinances, such as the ones that Mr. Mullooly was discussing. And I wouldn't be surprised if the League wasn't already doing that with respect to the Lawns to Legumes program. I mean, can you talk to what the League might already be doing to help disseminate this kind of information?
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, members of the committee, again, Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. And as I mentioned earlier, we are actively working with our cities on this issue, both as they individually approach us when residents ask them for help with this issue, and we specifically worked with the Board of Water and Soil Resources on the ordinances related to the Lawns to Legumes program, which some of that is the same as what you would use here. Some of it's slightly different, but it's still work on ordinances to modernize them to allow natural setting lawns is primarily, we get a lot of calls on that.
Yeah. Yeah, anything else, Representative Elkins?
Yeah, my next door neighbor has a clover lawn. He's a wildflower enthusiast and has milkweed and other wildflowers planted along the corners of the house. And is milkweed occasionally encroaches into my lawn, and I just mow around it because I like to see the monarch butterflies in late summer and in early fall. And to me, I think it's easy for the municipal level to be caught up in what are the plants versus are the plantings well maintained. And we can all look around our cities and see things like rain gardens or wildflower plantings, which almost anybody would agree look nice and are pollinator friendly at the same time. So the devil is in the details on stuff like this, but I don't think that a city should be banning clover lawns just because somebody doesn't think that clover looks as nice as bluegrass. Just a comment there. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Did you have a response, Mr. Johnson? Okay, looks like
Madam Chair,
okay, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this question would be directed towards Mr. Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. As of right now, if I had a property and I wanted to have a clover lawn or have, I really wanted to assist the pollinators, what is stopping me from going to my own local government and talking to them about the benefits of these pollinator-friendly lawns so they personally can have the decision to change their own ordinances? Why do we here at the state level have to dictate to the small cities or the large cities what's in their best interest? Would you, and here's the second question, if I were to contact you with the League of Minnesota Cities, would you help me to educate my own city council at the local government level?
Okay, and I think that was directed to Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and representative members of the committee, Craig Johnson again. And to your first question, nothing prevents anyone from going to their city council and asking them to consider changing ordinances to allow a different type of planting on their lawns or any other use of their property. You can always go to your city council to ask to have changes made to local ordinances. And this is no exception. It is very frequently done. And as you heard, we have lots of businesses all over the state that are successfully working in communities, putting these types of landscaping solutions in for private and for private properties and homeowner properties all over. So it is happening. It is changing. And if we are contacted at the league about this, we do have some model ordinances that we know are out there and have withstood legal challenges. And we also do match them up with state resources where they can look at other solutions that other communities are using.
Representative Olson, anything else?
No, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
Okay. I'm not seeing any other hands. So Representative Hansen, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank all of the testifiers for their presentations today. I think we may get lost a little bit in the weeds here in terms of what really we're talking about. And all of the good work, all of the work that has been discussed in terms of plantings by these businesses where landowners or businesses may be putting in pollinator gardens, if that city has an ordinance where it's a nuisance, the mayor, as the weed inspector, would have to go and take enforcement action on that pollinator garden. Maybe if it is funded even by Lawns to Legumes, if the city has not done so. And you could look in recent history in the Mankato, North Mankato area, I believe it even went to court where a landowner wanted the freedom to plant a pollinator garden on their own property. So what this bill does, what House File 2618 does, is it allows those landowners to have a pollinator garden if the city does not, so that the enforcement action, I would actually suggest that it was probably more unpopular for the mayor to be shutting down pollinator gardens than it is for the mayor to allow pollinator gardens. The world is changing all over the state, all over the country, and we should allow that, and that's what the bill does. It's not restricting. It is allowing people to plant pollinator gardens, rain gardens, et cetera. If we were just saying we allowed that and did not have the descriptions that are in the bill, I would assume we'd have opposition saying you're not describing what you mean. So we allow that in there. The bill is fairly clear. It's not talking about just letting your lawn go. So it does have conditions I believe would hold up, and it allows landowners to establish pollinator gardens. So I'd ask for your support. As I mentioned, I would work with Representative Quam. I think we have a good working relationship as this moves forward, but I would ask for your support right now.
Thank you. And I will renew my motion that House File 2618 be recommended to be re-referred to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. The clerk will take the roll, please.
Representative Mason?
Mason, aye.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Burt?
Yes.
Representative Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Hewitt, aye.
Representative Mecklen?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Joaquin?
Aye.
We have 6 ayes and 3 noes.
Thank you very much. So the motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Hansen and testifiers. Next, we'll move to House File 2894, which is Representative Hewitt. And we're going to try to finish this one by 9:40. Representative Hewitt, do you want to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I do.
Okay. Representative Hewitt is moving 2894. To be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. And I believe you do have an author's amendment. Do you want to move that?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move the DE2 amendment.
Okay, thank you. All right, he has moved the amendment. All those in favor, and if you would unmute, please. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Okay, the amendment is adopted. And if you would proceed, Representative.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for your time today and listening to this bill. I don't know if I have to say to the guests at home, I heard Representative Hansen before me there, so I was kind of impressed with his opening line. Anyways, what this bill simply does is give Dakota County the ability to do what all other counties outside the metro are already doing for subordinate taxation of townships and towns and cities that they're providing law enforcement for. What this also does is give those townships and towns and cities that were in this subordinate taxing district the ability to have more control over their public safety. So today, unfortunately, my sheriff, who's totally in support of this, had to catch a flight. But I do have one of our outstanding commissioners with us, Commissioner Slavik, and he'll go into more details and talk about, I believe he can also speak for the sheriff on this. Madam Chair, I would like to call up Commissioner Slavik, please.
Okay. Commissioner Slavik, please, and welcome.
Thank you and good morning, Madam Chair and members. As was said, my name is Mike Slavik. I am a Dakota County Commissioner for the 1st District. That includes the cities of Hastings and Farmington, but also 100% of the rural area in Dakota County. That is 13 townships and 7 cities under about 400 people in population. So roughly the rural area of Dakota County is about 18,000 people. And what the county is looking for is to be able to seek authority to operate a subordinate district for public safety for the rural areas of the county. This is something that, as Representative Hewitt had said, 81 counties already have that authority. The 6 metro counties, with the exclusion of Anoka County, already do not have that authority. With that delete all amendment, what we are looking to do is make this a very specific Dakota County rural public safety protection program What this will do is, right now, Dakota County levies county services that benefit only a portion of the county. So roughly about 350 square miles is the rural area, and 95% of the cost of public safety is right now paid for by parts of the county that receive none of those services, resulting in a double taxation. So what we are really looking for is to be able to use this authority for sheriff patrol services in the townships. I do know that you have two attachments, one that kind of gives you a diagram of what that service district looks like. And second with that is a letter of support from the Township Officers Association. So this is all of the 13 townships have signed off on and support being able to go and have a little more authority on what public safety looks like for their communities. And that, since the sheriff is not here, Madam Chair, I'll briefly say a little bit of what that looks like. The population has grown significantly in the last 25 plus years in Southern Dakota County. However, that has not kept up with the number of sheriff deputies, and the public safety is loved and adored in Southern Dakota County. However, with 300 plus square miles in the middle of the night, there's a lot more activity happening than happened 25 years ago. And you're running into situations where you have three sheriff deputies on patrol in the evening or in the middle of the night. And as a result, what has happened is, you know, you have one incident that might take majority of your sheriff deputies. And then you're having that third deputy just kind of sit in the middle of the county. We kind of use it as the fire truck analogy. They're waiting for, if there's a problem, they're kind of in the central part of the district. So what really one of this costs will be actually to add more sheriff deputies in the overnight hours for the rural areas. It's something they support and something they are willing to pay more for. It's just within state law, it's not acceptable at the moment, and we are hoping the consideration of this committee and the state legislature to move forward with this special rural public safety protection area. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm certainly open to any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. And I might mention that online there is the county's handout. And for the previous bill, there were also some written testimony. One was from Metro Cities, the other from the Audubon Minnesota organization. Just check online for the committee online to see those presentations. And I see Representative Quam has his hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if anyone could tell us how many counties currently have a tiered funding system for the Sheriff's Department.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Quam. This is somewhat of a unique system. I think Dakota County, if you look at how our makeup, we've got a rural area that's larger than about a third of the counties in Minnesota, just in the rural area. It's also a higher income level and a higher level of services, closer proximity to the metro area. So this is somewhat of a unique situation. Probably some of the closest examples would be what Anoka County's been able to do more on their 911 center, but not for, in terms of the sheriff and public safety. This is somewhat of a unique situation on this, but it's also Dakota County is somewhat unique in that.
Response, Representative Quam?
I think Representative Hoyt might be commenting on that. Dakota is not that dissimilar from Olmsted, which has the third largest city and has a rural area, but the county is dominated by the city of Rochester. But Representative, the author, I think, had some comments.
Okay. Next, and I'm apologizing.
Madam Chair. I wasn't done with the questioning.
I'm sorry.
The author wanted to say something.
Madam Chair, if I can speak.
Representative Hoyt.
And Madam Chair, Representative Quam, we are not prepared for that question yet. So what I will be doing for you is making sure I follow back up with you for that. And I believe if this bill moves out of this committee today, I will follow up and make sure I have it ready for state government finance.
Representative Chair,
thank you. The point being, setting a precedent for tiered funding is not trivial. And so if the county has a county program, and you tier it for different parts, pay different amounts for, you know, towards that. You know, I just want to make sure that we're not creating a precedence with this, and that's I consider as a non-trivial concern. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if Rep. Hewitt wants to take this or the county commissioner, but I haven't personally heard of a need of this, like in my townships, because obviously I have, you know, Elk River is our biggest hub, and then it's a lot of townships out here as well. But is there something that has suddenly driven this need? I mean, is there like, or has this been an ongoing thing for many years? Because I haven't heard of this in the past. I mean, is there something that particularly is driving this currently? And I may have a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Representative Meckland, that's a great question. And it's not really the all of a sudden need that we need all this, but it's the growth is number one in that part of the county. And also understand that this part of our county is also a major traffic area. We always think that possibility of crime in these areas, which I'm sure it has some, but we have major traffic, major high-speed traffic going through these areas as it's the major route to the casino at Treasure Island down there, and most of the traffic's at night. So these officers will be spending hours writing traffic reports, tickets, or whatever, and that's causing an upswing too. And then naturally, as the commissioner stated, that the growth in housing, which you and I both have worked on, have definitely added more time to patrol. So this is just urban. Well, it's not really urban. It's rural growth, because and it's also affordable land. And so you're seeing more and more growth down there. So I think that's the call. It's not that we're having this humongous peak. It's just that we need to make sure that these are protected. And then the need for these individuals within this townships and towns to have control over this. Right now, the commissioners can only give them so much revenue from around the other parts of the county because they have to take care of other things. And that they want to, if they want another officer, they should be able to get that. And right now they cannot. So we need to make sure that they can, they want the control over funding that. And there, I mean, to me, I had a lot of problems with this at first, but it makes a lot of sense to give the local people at the local level the control. And that's what they're doing here.
Any response, Representative Meekland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. So, you know, like yours, we have certain high traffic areas. I have Highway 10. You know, the city police deal with that as it passes through the cities on many cases, as well as the highway patrol. So, you know, and where I live, I'm way off the beaten path. So I know my response time is terribly long, but I guess I'm trying to understand, like, you know, I think many of our sheriff's departments certainly use more people. I know ours is a little bit low too, but I'm kind of concerned that this is just a spillover from all the rhetoric we've heard out of the metro and in the uptick in crime, because I'm hearing some of that side of it out here, or the lack of being able to hire more officers, or the lack of people willing to get into it. But, and I'm just really, really concerned if we're, like I think Rep. Quam mentioned, you know, we're setting a precedent, and I totally do agree with you, Rep. Hewitt, local control is always better, but then sometimes we see these local governments kind of run amok too. And help me understand this. So I guess here's my question. We're all paying taxes that help fund this. Is there something that townships are exempted from with that I'm not aware of, that with regard to the 911 operations and or the cost that goes into financing the sheriff's department? Can somebody answer that question?
Madam Chair, can I speak again?
Representative Hewitt.
Yeah, make no mistake, this is a vote on public safety. This is about providing more public safety to this part of the county. It's plain and simple. They're coming, your county can do this already, Representative Meckland, very clearly, and others can do it. There's only one other metro county that can do something like this. It's Anoka. This gives Dakota County, the largest rural county in the metro area, the ability to do the same. But this is very simple. They're not talking about parks or anything like that. This is a vote for public safety in this area. Plain, simple, straightforward.
Anything else, Representative Meekland?
Yes, I have one more thing. Representative Hewitt, I will support your bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson, and then Representative Joachim.
Yeah, this is just a quick question. I think the commissioner might be able to answer. My question is, don't townships, so you've got a township down there. I was looking, there's 2,400 people in that township, which is as large as some of my cities or larger than the majority of my cities. Is there something preventing the township board from increasing their own township taxes to do something like what I've got, the city of Welcome and the city of Sherburne, population 1,000, population 800, who tie in together and they have their own police department. Is there something that is preventing the townships from performing a similar action, contracting out with the sheriff's department? I know my city of Elmore, we've been talking about getting rid of our police officer for so long because it cost us almost $100,000 and we only have a $500,000 budget. And so we've been talking with the sheriff's department about contracting with them for extra hours. Is there something that's preventing the townships from being able to dictate their own tax rates, to utilize their taxes towards increasing public safety? Is there something that's preventing the townships themselves, the very basic level of local government, from doing what we're talking about here?
Commissioner Slavik.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Olson. Actually, that township in your reference to, because of the number of calls, particularly on mental health, public safety, they have actually been in discussions. This conversation, for reference, has been kind of an idea for the last couple of years, just has not necessarily progressed forward. In that interim, that township actually has been working with the sheriff to get extra hours of a deputy. So that option is still available, no different than your fire protection on a contract. However, that doesn't necessarily address the issue. That addresses individual one township or one municipality. It does not necessarily address the entire patrol area, which, as I had stated, over 50% of the land of the county is the rural area for a county of 440,000 people. Half of the geographic land is this rural area.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I appreciate the answer. And then when you're creating these districts, last follow-up question, when you're creating these districts, would you be taxing similarly your township that had somewhere near 100, I think it was like 120 people living in that township, the same rate as the 2,400 population township? Because in my mind, the 2,400 population would definitely need and utilize the sheriff at a rate that far exceeds that of the 120 population township.
Commissioner Slavik.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how it was deemed to be done was going to be on property values. So overall, collectively, the district's about 5% of the overall tax base is based on value. Majority of the townships, as I had shared earlier, are a higher market value than much of the rest of the county, actually. And that's fairly consistent amongst most of the there's not one pocket that has extremely high values compared to another. But that is certainly I think the county would be willing to look at something if there are certain changes that address population as opposed to market value.
Follow-up, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That I appreciate that answer. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Next, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. You were basically reading my mind. I think one of the things people forget sometimes, it's the will and the tax capacity for that area to be able to do something. And that was my question. You kind of segued into tax capacity. So are you looking at increasing the levy in just those areas, and then in the other areas, they're going to have a release of that levy on that particular service? Because I'm just trying to figure out how the tax interactions happen with property tax refunds. So I know, you know, this might bump some people into the refund category, and we have to look at that as well. So just wondering how your tax structure is going to look.
Commissioner Slavik.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. So as the county board and the township officers have had discussions on this, the idea would be that the current level of service would continue to be funded by all county taxpayers. So that 95% in essence would be the overall public safety budget for The township area is roughly $4.3 million. And what the idea on this was is to be able to, really the goal was to add, we've done an analysis and a study to be able to increase the protection of the rural areas is roughly about four deputies. So the idea would be to use this to be able to add four more deputies to the cost. So in essence, they would still be paying the base level, and so would the residents of all of the large cities within Dakota County, but the additional service would be added with this taxing district.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. That explains it a little bit better, and I think for folks in the metro area whose counties don't have this capability, if you kind of think of it as a special taxing district that you might do for adding in streetlights somewhere, it's kind of similar. I just wanted to ask, because since you're keeping the same level of service, but then this area might be increasing their levy, there may be some property tax refund interactions that we have to think about in tax division land. So thank you. And I trust Representative Hewitt will be working on the bill as he always does as it moves up to different committees. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think a better approach for doing this would be allowing the mechanism for a township or small city, et cetera, to negotiate with the sheriff's department and the county to be able to add a, additional funding for an augmented service. The current structure of this bill seems very much, well, we're going to add a surcharge to some of our people in our county, but everybody else is paying the normal amount for this county service. And I queried if this was an existing practice or not, because when we open up the door to some new way of taxing some of the people or parts of the county or parts of it, so it's like Minneapolis saying, we're going to double your tax in this part of Minneapolis because we have to have more law enforcement patrolling. And I think that's wrong. I think public safety should be a common function of the government. And so I think the intent of the bill, I have no problem with the intent of the bill. It's how we're opening up an opportunity or precedent, unless there's already been one that nobody can tell me there is, which I take as being a higher burden. But I'm fine with trying to assist the author with maybe a different approach. I just have reluctance with the current way this has been presented functionality wise, because I take seriously the common good being funded by the community. And so I'm hoping that this bill has a better form as it progresses. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt. We can't hear you. There you go.
I don't think too many people were upset about that. Anyways, to continue, Representative Quam, naturally, we will look towards making the bill better. And as always, I always appreciate your advice. Thank you so much for that. And as we move forward and look at other possible things, we will continue along the pathway with changes that need to be made.
Is there any counter, Representative Quam?
No, I've worked with the author before, and that's why we have committee hearings in order to make bills better and better.
Okay, not seeing any other hands, Representative Hewitt. Would you like to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, today for this robust hearing. It is almost close to 9:40, and we're going to get you on track here. So, thank you for the people of Dakota County. Thank you, my testifier, for coming on Zoom today. And unfortunately, we couldn't hear from our sheriff, but we will work on this bill as it progresses. It's a very local control and public safety bill. And so we will continue our pathway here, hopefully. And thank you, committee members. And I do renew my motion to move it on to state government finance, I believe. Is that correct?
Right. You were referring it back to state government finance and election committee. And if the clerk would take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Kwan.
No.
Representative Burr.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Joaquin.
Aye.
We have 7 ayes and 2 nays.
Okay, so the motion prevails and you're on your way, Representative. Thank you very much and thank you, Commissioner. Next, we have House File 2454, and I will move that bill to be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. Representative Nelson, would you like to tell us about your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and my bill is to add 2 members to the Public Utilities Commission in the city of Mora. Right now, it's kind of the typical 3-member commission that that statute allows, and this would just allow adding 2 more members, and just it makes it a little bit easier, especially in a small town when you have open meeting laws and things like that. That having 2 members, or you know, if there's 2 members that end up meeting in a gas station or a grocery store and happen to say something about pertaining to the commission, why you're in violation of an open meeting law. And it's, you know, especially in small towns, it becomes difficult. The city of North Branch had done this a few years back, and I would just appreciate your support. And I have 2 testifiers, Mayor Scramstead and then Greg Ardner, to testify to this today, and if there's, I'll stand for any questions. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. And is there a preference as to who goes first?
No, ma'am, Chair.
Okay.
I'm Alan Scramstead. I'm the mayor of Mora.
Okay, and proceed, please.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair. Alan Scramstead, I am the mayor of Mora, and we are here to testify on our asking for the authority to go to a 5-man board for our PUC. This was brought up about a year ago, but because of the issues at last year, it didn't get heard. So we thank you for your time. I'm going to turn it over to our chair of our Public Utilities Commission, Greg Ardner, and he has some background on this. Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Ardner. State your name for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greg Ardner, and I serve as the chairman of the Public Utilities Commission in Mora. I represent a 3-person commission that oversees all aspects of our electrical, water, and sanitary sewage utilities within the city of Mora. This board manages a fiscal budget of approximately $8 million a year, with reserves of about $23 million. We do this by providing up-to-date and cost-effective utilities to our residents. We make investments to secure property utility upgrades and to counter any catastrophic issues that may arise in the future. We provide programs and incentives for customer assistance. We encourage conservation through best practices and rebates. Employment of staff for the very different but necessary utilities is a major part of our role. We oversee monthly collections and resolutions to provide utility services. Some of the reasons for supporting House File 2454 include the fact that we have changing demographics, especially in our region, where we have younger members coming forward to participate in city functions. This brings up conflicting priorities due to family, business, illness, or other personal business. Absence of even one member puts more pressure on proper decisions. Absence of two members, and there is no quorum, and decisions need to be put off at the expense of staff and customers. A five-member board would help reduce any future issues. A precedent has been set by the legislature with regards to the city's North Branch, Melrose, and Elk River in establishing a five-member board. I've been involved with the City of Mora government for almost 30 years. I have served as mayor, councilperson, planning commission member, economic development authority president, and many other boards and commissions. In each case, all of these city groups are represented by five-member boards. It's hard to understand why the Mora Public Utility Commission, which is also the largest monetary entity in the City of Mora, is limited to just three members. I ask for your support for House File 2454. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My question to the mayor would be, are these paid chair positions on the board, or are they voluntary?
Mayor Stramstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, they are paid members of the board.
Representative Olson.
Okay, so I understand the issues with the quorum and everything. This is a vote to expand mm-hmm. government. So this is a tough one for me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any Representative Meekland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe the author can answer this or one of the two testifiers, but what is the total cost to local government by adding these two additional members?
Representative Nelson, do you want to take that?
I think I'll have to refer to the mayor. As my understanding, it is the city council and the mayor that set the, I don't know if it's the salary or what the compensation for the council, for the PUC members.
Okay, Mayor Scramstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The the PUC members receive about $2,000 a year, so it would increase the budget by about $4,000.
Thank you. Representative Meekland, any counter?
Yes, Madam Chair. One of the two testifiers indicated that if you can't meet quorum, it costs the city, you know, staff resources to have to put off important votes. Do you have a rough idea in a given year what your costs were when quorums weren't able to be met due to someone not being able to attend or illness, what have you? And would that offset this new incurred cost?
Okay.
Madam Chair, I will take that question. Utilities.
Proceed, Mayor.
It happens now and then. It's not a set thing that happens on an annual basis. We have had in the past, we've had one of the members be very ill and miss most of the meetings for over a year. Why that happened? The Utility Commission didn't have the heart to take him off, so all the decisions were made by the other two. In the past year, I'd say it happened maybe twice.
Representative Meekland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That'll be all.
Okay. Oh, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mayor or Commissioner, what was the budget for the organization again that you're in charge of?
Okay. We'd like to take that.
I will, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mayor,
our fiscal budget is approximately $8 million a year. We carry reserves of almost $23 million just to cover any catastrophic issues that might arise in the city. Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Madam Chair, either one of you two, how many hours a year do they usually put in? It sounds like that's a big budget for just three people to have to handle, and I'm sure you probably have subcommittees or folks having to do extra meetings, and that's kind of hard to do with just three people.
Would like to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, Mayor, besides the staff, city staff is involved, all decisions are made by the three-member board. There are no subcommittees.
Okay. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to support the bill. You know, boards and commissions are honors to serve on, and it doesn't sound like $2,000 for the all the time they put in is that much to ask for. And sometimes really it is better to have more people at the table, especially if unexpected circumstances come up. So just wanted to get a little bit more information. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Nelson, do you have any final words?
Thank you for hearing this today, and I would just appreciate your support. And as several have stated, that you know, this is nearly an $8 million, you know, annual budget, and you know, it's a very small percentage of extra cost that it'll be the city of Mora and their residents that pay for this. And you know, I think it's something that they feel important to have, and would appreciate the support on this. So, thank you for hearing this today, and I would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Representative Kwan, would you like to renew the motion for House File 2454?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
Again, Representative Kwan renews the motion that House File 2454 be referred to State Government, Finance, and Elections Committee. Clerk will take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Kwan.
Aye.
Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Joachim.
Yes.
We have 9 ayes.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, you're on your way. Thank you so much to everybody who participated today, and the meeting is now adjourned.